please come to order. With us this morning, we have Representative Wilson on the right, Vice Chair Keller on my right. We have Representative Peterson on the left and Representative Seaton. And today we have HB 351 Police Officer Protection Certifications on agenda, as well as SCR 17 Girl Scout 100th Anniversary, and SB 53 Commission on the Status of Women. And I have a bill up in some place, and I have to leave it about 9:15 to present that. So at this point, Vice Chair Keller will take over the meeting. I'm not deserting you. First up today is going to be Governor's Appointments. Oh, I forgot about that, Governor's Appointments. I'm going to hold that and go to the next one, because the sponsor's next bill, one of them has to leave right away. So let's go to HB 351 first. The sponsors will come up, and we have, my goodness sakes. Okay. We have a brand new CS on this, which I think may help with some of the issues we had the other day. And it's my intention to hear the CS, explain the CS, and then, as I understand it, there are a lot of different changes within the CS. You're nodding your head, yes, and you'd like to explain that. And then we have a lot of folks scheduled to testify, but since the CS breaks some new ground here, I think, my intent right now is to hold the bill after we get the CS explained, so we can all digest it just a little bit better. Then next we'll go to the governor's appointments and go on down from there. So with that satisfactory, good morning. Would you all please introduce yourselves and just a super brief recap of the bill and then the CS. I'm not sure everybody has a CS. Okay. And then we'll get a motion at the appropriate time to move the CS. Good morning. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, Anchorage.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Julie Lucky, I'm staff for Representative Mike Hawker.
And Mr. Chairman, as you introduced the current circumstance, I believe that's exactly where we're at today. My capable aide, Ms. Julie, has been working with the parties of interest in this legislation, working to assemble a CS that both sides could support. We are not quite completed with that task. But the draft CS in front of you is sufficiently mature that we very much appreciate the opportunity for Julie to explain it to the committee, and it is our desire that you hold the bill in committee today.
Okay. Thank you. That's lucky.
So to start, we did prepare a new, a new matrix.
Should we bring the new version before for discussion.
Working document.
What a great idea. Would somebody please?
I would move version M of the blank CS 351. That's LS 1352 Mike for a working copy.
Okay. Any objection for discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd object for discussion of the changes.
Okay. Thank you. With that, we'll continue.
Again, for the record, Julie Lucky from Representative Mike Hawker's office, and I'm hoping that you all received a new matrix. It should have a new column on there so that we can discuss what the changes are. During the last hearing, we basically discussed the first item in the matrix, which was the licensure impacts for misconduct. We did a little bit of discussion on the other issues, but what I'd like to focus on today was a few changes made in the CS to deal with the licensure impacts for misconduct, which are sections 1 and 2. The one item that we seem to have some consensus on was that everybody was okay with allowing suspension, so that has not been changed in the CS. The main objection that we heard during the last hearing was that we did not want to tie the hands of the council to a decision made by a hearing officer or to a prior decision made by a court or during arbitration if there were some issues, and I'll call it the bad apple in the cart that Representative Wilson had brought up, that even if they do go through arbitration, that might have been decided on another issue, and we don't want to tie the council's hands from being able to discipline somebody that meets some criteria of acting poorly. basically. To that end, what we have done in the CS is, in the Section 1, we have made it clear that suspension can be done before filing an accusation or statement of issues. However, a revocation or refusal to issue would happen after filing an accusation. And in Section 2, it's page 2, line 1, we have "and delivering notice." That was one of the difficulties that was brought up, was that they felt that they didn't get adequate notice. So we wanted to be sure that the process is clear in the statute. What we did take out was the language that said, if the decision is consistent with if refusal or revocation is consistent with the decision. And what that does is that takes away the binding of the council on a decision made by a hearing officer. It is my understanding, although I'm not an expert on the Administrative Procedures Act, I have tried to read it, that if they deviate from a hearing officer, they do have to provide in writing why that was done. And that's covered under the Administrative Procedures Act. So what Section 1 of the bill now does is it does allow for the suspension, and it's very clear about what the process will be for revocation of a certificate or refusal to reissue a certificate.
I'd like to point out Representative Gruenberg joined us, as well as Representative Johansson has joined us. Please continue.
There have not been any changes to Section 2, as we feel the language was not contentious. However, it is a policy call of whether or not they are held to a preponderance of evidence, as is currently in the Administrative Procedures Act, or if they go with clear and convincing evidence. So there have been no changes to that section. I know that that is still a point of contention. That is a policy call that we, that the committee would be able to make. Section 3 of the bill had to do with the deference to prior resolutions. So in the previous version of the bill, what the bill had said was that the council cannot go back after someone has been through arbitration and court cases. We had a lot of discussion about that, and basically just revoke or refuse or suspend a certificate after someone had already been through their process. There was concern about that because if somebody was misconduct, we do want a method to decertify somebody that does not meet the minimum standards, whether or not they prevailed in the court case. And so this, based on our conversation with our legal drafter, this has had the most change. Section 3 has had the most change. And now what Section 3 does, it says that in a proceeding to revoke, suspend, or refuse a certificate to an officer, the council may not consider evidence closely related to a disciplinary action that has been reversed or removed or is in dispute under one of the various arbitration, under a collective bargaining agreement, personnel rules, that's being disputed in, or has been decided under the Administrative Procedure Act, or we have added number 4, an appeal to a court. What we have also added is Section B, and that is starting on page 2, line 22, and this is the exceptions. So we are not tying the council's hands. I mean, we are basically saying that you cannot consider this evidence. However, there are 7 exceptions to that rule. So if somebody has willfully falsified information to obtain their certificate, has willfully falsified information to obtain warrants, make arrests, or violate the rights of a person, has an addiction to alcohol or a controlled substance and has not reported the addiction to the employer and tried to get treatment, has engaged in conduct that is a state or federal criminal offense, except for certain offenses like a traffic offense or infractions or a Class B misdemeanor, engaged in sexual conduct that is prohibited by law or the police officer's employer, was discharged from service in a branch of the armed forces of the United States for serving dishonorably. And then Section 7, I might have to call a lifeline to help me out, has to do with, I believe it's called a Garrity warning. And these, as I understand it, and I can call my lifeline to help out with this one, these are items that are either in the regulations now for the council to revoke a certificate or are kind of a standard practice. These are reasons that police officer certificates are, I guess, the common egregious misconduct that is used as a basis to revoke someone's certificate. So basically what that section does is it does still have a prohibition against the council taking action on something that is currently being disputed or has been decided by a court. However, in these 7 circumstances, the council could take action at any time, regardless of what a court had found or regardless of whether or not a dispute is currently happening. And those are the changes to the licensure misconduct provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm those 7 were this, those seven, are those new or are were those already there?
Through the chairman, Representative Wilson, those were not currently in the bill. The bill before had a blanket prohibition against undoing basically a deference to prior resolutions. So if you had a case that had gone through the court or gone through arbitration, we had basically tied the council's hands of going back and undoing that. And so what we heard in the committee was that was unacceptable. So what we have tried to do is said these are some exemptions for which the council could come back. So it's new to the bill. I think the concepts are things that are, the common reasons for which a certificate might be revoked already.
I'm not. So the council can go ahead and start over, but they can't consider any of the evidence that was gathered the first time. I explain that a little bit to me.
And Representative Lynn, Representative Wilson, unfortunately, I am not a lawyer, although
Fortunately,
this was language that was actually recommended by the drafter, and what we had had before was basically if a case has gone all the way through, the council cannot go back and undo something. Mm-hmm. The question became, what if there is something that's currently in dispute, right? So you have an employment, and the intent of this section, the overall intent of this section, is to separate the employment actions, which might be going through a collective bargaining agreement, from revocation actions, which are an officer does not meet the minimum standards of the council, right? So there's two different things going on. And the intent of this section was that if you go through an employment action through arbitration or collective bargaining agreement, that the council, which is in charge of making sure you meet minimum standards, a licensee meets minimum standards, can't come in and override the employment. So that the best way to make that distinction, according to our drafters, was to basically say evidence closely related to the disciplinary action that has been reversed or removed or in dispute. And the intent of that language is to say, right, the employment action is being taken because of maybe the person was tardy or the person, the person had some misconduct. So other than these seven exceptions we have set out, the council wouldn't be able to basically have the same case in front of them that is currently being dealt with in collective bargaining, arbitration, or personnel, or in court. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I'll just have to study it, which I'll do, because I've got to get figure it out myself. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, that's one of the reasons that we thought maybe today was not shouldn't be the last day. I know that despite our best efforts, the CS came out late, and it did come out with some changes I was not quite anticipating. I think that they do make the bill better, but I think that we all need a little bit more time to digest exactly what the language means.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
Thank you. I can solve the confusion with one big amendment that would make the bill a lot simpler, but I don't think we're quite there yet. So.
That's the amendment you had in the packet here?
No, that's just popping around in my brain.
Popping around in your brain? I thought I heard some noises.
Very easy.
I thought one of my colleagues was shaking their head. Okay.
It would simplify the bill greatly, Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
And then continuing on, I don't know if there's any, I know that we had wanted to try to keep this by topic, so that's kind of my conclusion on the sections 1 through 3, which have to do with licensure revocations by the council, so I didn't know if there might be more questions on that.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to understand the goal and the effect of this. It seems like what we're saying is that we're going to limit the amount of evidence that the Police Standard Council can obtain, and we are laying out seven reasons, and those are basically going to be the only reasons that then can be used by the council to revoke a license, because B is notwithstanding A, it's saying these are what they can revoke or suspend a license for. So is my understanding correct, and does the current Police Standard Council have a list of seven things that are the only reasons that they can revoke or not issue a license?
And through the chairman, Representative Seaton, in our legislation, that would only be, these seven exceptions would be the exceptions to considering evidence that has already been decided through another process, or is it currently in dispute in another process? Are these seven reasons do not actually apply to any revocation actions that could be taken by the council on an issue that has not already been decided or on an issue that is not in dispute? It is the intent of this section to say, if you are currently in arbitration or if you have finished arbitration on a particular item, that that particular item would not be a basis for the council to bring a revocation action unless it meets one of the seven standards.
Follow up. So, and I'll have to refer, so 1865-244, that whole section only relates to actions after there's been a subsequent court case or grievance procedure. It doesn't relate to, as it says, notwithstanding these others, you can only use through this.
Through the chairman, Representative Seaton. Due to the drafter's change, it would apply to something that had been completed, so an arbitration or a court case or a personnel or an APA process that had been completed or one in dispute, but your understanding is correct. Section B will only apply to the circumstances in Section A, which means these seven reasons can be used no matter, regardless of whether or not there is currently, that item is currently in dispute or that item has been decided already by a process through any of the three avenues or four avenues.
Yes. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. So what it looks like to me that as long as sometimes appeals take a long, long time, and so what is this essentially is allowing the person to do is to stay out on the street, do his thing, and keep going until the whole thing is over. So all he has to do is keep making appeals, and he'll be able to do what he wants.
Through the chairman, Representative Wilson, other than actions that are listed in 1 through 7.
Okay.
So if a person, for instance, falsified information to obtain their certificate, regardless of whether or not they were going through a court case or a termination proceeding, the council could bring action at any time. If the person was accused of a sexual misconduct case, the council could concurrently take a case up. They wouldn't have to wait until the appeal. So any of these seven exceptions would be the exceptions under which the council could take action regardless of a past disposition or a current process.
Follow up. So if he's been engaged in sexual misconduct, as long as it wasn't while he was on duty, he gets to keep until the appeals end.
Through the chair, I did not actually write this section, but that is how I read it.
Okay.
And this is, I'm sorry if I may continue, through the chair, Representative Wilson. I think this is one of the reasons that we want to make sure that people have time to digest the CS, just to ensure that what we were trying to do was use current practices and the regulations to come up with a list that would encompass most of the things that I know that the committee members did have some unease with, not being able to come in and take a certificate of what I would call a bad apple, or, you know, someone that has some serious misconduct. And this was kind of the easiest way to get it so people could understand what it was.
Yeah. And we'll get some legal advice on that when the time comes.
Mr. Chairman.
One.
Thank you. And so 244 is they cannot consider evidence from a court that a court has found or grievance procedures have determined is true. So are we giving them subpoena power to obtain that evidence that they previously could use from a court finding or from a grievance procedure that went through or is in process? Employment actions, are we providing them with another avenue for obtaining that information since we're restricting them from using that information that was, well, it's even closely related to the disciplinary acts, and it doesn't even need to have been the actual finding in the court, I guess. Have we provided that in this CS?
And through the chairman, Representative Seaton, that is not addressed in the CS. I'm unsure if that, and I apologize, this was not, this was language that came over from the drafter, and so what, with the committee's indulgence, what I would like to do is get a little bit more information about what the drafter had written. And just, I can clarify one part, is that it would only apply to court cases, arbitration, where the termination had been reversed. So if the court finds for the, you know, against the officer, that's not addressed here. This is only where an officer has gone through a process that is laid out either by the APA, by their collective bargaining agreement, a court process, the officer has prevailed. And so what we're saying is, in that case, then evidence closely related to the points that the officer prevailed upon cannot be used. So this wouldn't, if the court obviously upheld the termination, although I don't think that...
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. And just, you know, putting the issues on the table so you can come back to us, it seems like or is in dispute on line 14. So that means as long as it's going through a court case and on appeal, it looks like the they could not use any of that information to do it. So I just want to put on the table to make sure we're understanding.
Thank through the chairman, Representative Seaton, that is correct, other than misconduct that is enumerated in items 1 through 7. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
And the other sections of the bill we touched on a little bit during the last committee, and so I'm going to just go through quickly the analysis of those sections and take any questions that I can on those so that we have the whole picture ahead of us. The second item on the matrix is the definition of a police officer, and it would be there's been no change to this section. It would be adding court services officers to the definition of police officer. What we heard in committee was it seems like they're already going that direction, so the approach that the sponsor kind of put forward is possibly putting a delayed effective date on that section, if that's happening anyway. At this point, I have not heard back from the department on how long a delayed effective date they would need, or whether or not this would address the problems that they had in their fiscal note, and so that's one of the reasons we'd like to.
Is that the amendment at the back of the package?
There is an amendment at the back of the package that would add the effective date, correct. It would not change the section, but it would add a delayed effective date to that section.
Okay, thank you. Continue.
And there's been no changes to that section in the CS. In the sections 5 through 6, we talk about the administration of lie detector tests. The CS has been changed to conform to, we did bring up last committee meeting that we had only intended for this to apply to current employees and not bar the use of lie detector tests during the application process. So the current CS has been changed to reflect what was originally the sponsor's intent. And so that would be sections 5 and 6 of the bill. And the last section, which I don't think the committee actually discussed while we were here in the last session, was the confidentiality of personal information. There have been no changes to this section, and what the section basically says is that personal information that is held by the employer, the agency, including home photos and home addresses, is considered confidential, and they would have to have the officer voluntarily authorize its release in writing. There are some exceptions, which include if an officer has been lawfully arrested, a photograph, any information included in a 911 call, a police investigative report, or a complaint made to law enforcement or a witness statement. So those things obviously would not be protected. There's been some concern, and it might be easier if you'd like the whys on that to have for me to pull up one of my lifelines. But the only opposition that we have heard to that section of law, because it's common sense to kind of not put officers' home addresses out there, is the issue of photos. There's some concern that we would have to go to all the police stations everywhere and take the photos down. It is obviously not our intent. Nothing that I've discussed with the drafter has stated that would be the case. This is our intent is going forward, that nobody would have to take down a lot of photographs. We envision a waiver process being much like I have dealt with a waiver process with my own child at daycare, where they have a form that says, I allow use of my photograph for promotional activities, yes or no. That could be taken care of with a simple signature at the beginning of a hiring process for the release of photographs. I have heard no opposition to the release of home addresses, and I think that's pretty straightforward.
Thank you. A question, Representative Keller, and then we go to Representative Wilson.
If we could go back up to Section 3, if you could talk to us a little bit about the section on refusable answer. I've been trying to get my head around that first time I see it here, and I'm assuming, you know, things could probably, because I just don't know how they work, but does this imply an upstream kind of a Miranda, you know, I mean, you have to tell them precisely, tell a police officer precisely what's going on and what that would look like. I mean, who would notify the police officer of those circumstances? You know, who'd be the responsible to do that? Is that a new process? I see both the employer and the council. Yeah, there has to be a notification, and I'm just, you know, is this brand new? That's quite a bit of, quite a large section related to refusal to answer, and I'm just trying to understand it.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, just so I know that I'm discussing the same thing you are you talking about the language in subsection 7 on page 3, lines 8 through 21?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and if I may ask your indulgence and have one of my lifelines come up, this is the section that I talked about. I'm not so familiar with this. I guess it's called a Garrity warning, and it's a process that is in place, but I would prefer to have somebody that's a little bit more.
Would you give me the name? Or
I don't know who's this chick.
It doesn't have to be right now either. I just wanted to get the question on the record, and you can go ahead and...
Why don't we do that then? Because I want to press ahead. Yeah. I know the sponsor has to catch an airplane here in a little bit, and we have other stuff on the agenda. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I want to go to Section 6 on page 4. And this is quite a change with the word because... And because before it could be one or two, and now we've added or three. However, now we've changed one. It has to be one and two together. Those things have to happen together before it can happen. So, can you just kind of go into that, why that was changed? So, because before it was this or this or this. And now it's this and this or this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, are you talking about on Section 6 of the bill?
Section 6 on lines 22 to the 31.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, it is my understanding, and I will double check with the drafter, it is not our intent to make it an and. It is my understanding that just by removing the or and then moving it down to the section, that it would still be a choice of one or two or three.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that, but it usually when we have something like that, we usually go one or two or three, and now it's one, two, to, you know, or three.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, I understand the question, and I will be sure to ask our legal drafter and make sure that our opinion is correct. The way I read it, it would be one, two, or three because that we did not insert an and. However, I understand the question. I will make sure to confirm that.
Okay, Chair.
Reverend Grunberg.
On that point, it's all disjunctive. You don't have to say one or two or three. You say one, two, or three. That makes them all disjunctive.
Okay. Anything further? Okay. Reverend Johansson.
Oh, no. I was confirming Representative Gruenberg's comment to Representative Peterson. It's consistent with common drafting structure, so there's nothing.
Okay. Anybody else want to confirm Representative Gruenberg's advice? I will. Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor's representative, Representative Seaton?
I did have a question on, I guess, in Section 1 under the suspension. And at some point when the, you know, people are testifying, what I want to get answered is, what is the purpose of the suspension? Is this a new disciplinary tool so that if someone is found to be not sufficiently moral or honest or something to be a police officer, we're now going to suspend their license for 90 days and say, well, maybe in 90 days you'll be now more truthful. And I'm troubled that we are changing the Police Standards Council from a council that says, these are the minimum requirements. If you don't meet these, you don't get a certificate, or your certificate will be revoked, to a council that says, okay, now we're going to be a disciplinary council, and if you're untruthful or immoral or something, you can come in and we'll negotiate and give you a suspension for a certain period of time, and then you can show us that you have become a truthful person, those kind of things. So I would like to have the issue of suspension discussed in the terms of, are we changing the entire purpose of the Police Standards Council, setting minimum standard for police officers, to this kind of graduated thing of training? We're trying to adjust people's responsibility or how they're qualified to be to have the certificate. So thank you.
Chairman, Representative Seaton, I understand the question. The one circumstance that it was brought up to me that suspension might be a better choice is if somebody is seeking treatment for maybe an alcohol or chemical addiction. You could send that officer to a program for a certain amount of time and suspend the license while the person is going through that treatment, with the ability then to revoke or reinstate at the end of that treatment, and give the officer a chance to rehabilitate themselves prior to actually the revocation of the license. And it might, what I can do is I will find out if there's other opportunity or other, you know, reasons that would be used. And also it might be helpful, which I'll provide to the committee, is there was some question last time about how to be recertified and what the difference would be between being able to suspend someone for a certain amount of time versus revocation and the person having to go through the process of being recertified and what conditions are on that.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman. And that's my question is, if we're now getting into we're going to modify your behavior, instead of having a floor, we're going to have a training program, which I'm not sure that has been the purview of the council. And I know that there's been testimony that people can voluntarily relinquish their permits and reapply, and so I just want to make sure that we're from the people that are involved in the, you know, on both sides of this issue, I just want them to address it. So thank you very much,
and appreciate those. Mr. Chairman, I understand the question, and we'll do our best to make sure that we're prepared when the bill comes up.
Thanks.
Okay, Reverend Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ms. Lucky. The only legal memorandum I really can find on the subject is the ACLU legal memorandum of the 4th of April.
We have Jeff Mittman here to say something.
I'll be interested in hearing what Mr. Mittman has to say. But I'm looking at the first section of the bill here. It looks like the council under the bill will be able to suspend a certificate before filing an accusation or a statement of issues. As the bill sponsor, is it your intent that they have to provide any kind of statement of reasons to the officer?
Through the chairman, Representative Gruenberg, I understand. We did try to come by your office yesterday and discuss this with you. I know that there have been some concerns about what needs to be done prior to suspension. This is one of the reasons that I believe that we need a little bit more time to work on the bill, and I would appreciate an opportunity to work with your office and figure out what.
Sure.
Our intent was to make sure that there was a way, because what people were concerned about was there seemed to be instances where the council would basically say, we're going to, you know, can you voluntarily relinquish your license, because they didn't have a suspension process in place. And I believe it was the sponsor's intent to allow a immediate suspension when you see something going wrong, so that there's time to go through the process. So the first step isn't necessarily decertification, revocation. I understand there are some due process concerns, and
I'm with you. Just, we're flagging the issue. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the last hearing we're going to have on the bill, and then it goes to judicial. I think I appreciate what you're doing. I support the process you're going through here. I gather there is somewhere that states that the hearing, et cetera, will be conducted by the Office of Administrative Hearings. Who conducts the hearings? It's the administrative law judge, is that right?
Through the chairman, Representative Gruenberg, when we say under AS 4462-330-630, that is the Administrative Procedures Act, where they talk about the hearings and how that is done.
But it is, that includes the statutes on the Office of Administrative Hearings, I take it?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, correct.
Okay. I'm going to be interested in what Mr. Mittman has to say on some of these things, and I'm kind of just flagging something for you, where they talk about clear and convincing evidence, and the ACLU has not found any license revocation proceeding where clear and convincing evidence is the standard. We have Mr. Sanders and some other lawyers here in the office in the audience. I thought to take action on your bar license, the standard is clear and convincing. Yeah, they're nodding. So, anyway, I'm just sort of rambling on that. Thank you very much. This is a lot to digest on the fly.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I was flipping through the pages here, I noticed that there's this amendment page here. Is that an amendment that the sponsor is offering on this bill, or are we going to talk about that now?
Through the chairman, Representative Peterson, to be perfectly honest, this is one of the reasons that I think that we need a little bit more time on the bill. So at this point, I would prefer to disregard the amendments. The language that came back from the draft was not exactly what I was expecting, and there's a few items that we need to figure out if it should have been one way or the other. And so, therefore, at this point, I would prefer to disregard the amendments so that we have a little bit more time to digest those sections of the bill and get a little bit more feedback on whether or not the amendments are necessary.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is Gruenberg for the record. I'm particularly interested, and again, I'm looking at the ACLU stuff here, at looking at the contours of what a person in the position of an accused police officer here is, what rights they have under the Due Process Clause, both of the state and federal constitution. I'm not looking for an answer today, but as were you and I, or whoever you're going to be working with, or, you know, I'll be working with. And I'll just leave it at that. This is a bill that has lots of constitutional and policy dimensions, because I think too often in the legislature, the only standard we look at is whether something's constitutional. We are the first judge of whether something is right and fair and just and good public policy. And even if something happens to be constitutional, that doesn't necessarily mean it's good public policy. And I'm not just talking about
this
bill.
That's exactly right. I'm going to hear several cases.
Yeah, I actually have been thinking about this, and I think that and the State Affairs Committee and the Judiciary Committee, and I know the other committees too, we kind of sometimes lose track on what our real goal is. It's not just to give somebody or the society the standard of the Constitution. We have to look at whether something's right and just and good policy.
Amen.
So it's okay. I'm just going to.
Don't do it.
I'm not going to say it. Representative Peterson, I was going to talk about the current thing that's going on with the United States Supreme Court, and he was saying that they can't overturn past legislation.
Well, yeah, I think that's something worth thinking about for all of us, I think. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Representative Johansson.
I just did want the conversation to continue. Representative Seaton brought up on the suspension portion, and I wanted to make sure that our conversation was broadened to what the statute actually says. And the references that the representative talked about was if there was a moral problem or if someone lied, that, you know, maybe we could suspend them and somehow cure them from lying or whatever. But I want to make it clear that in the standards in 18.65.240, we're talking about other things as well: education, physical standards, mental standards, mm-hmm. things that can be addressed, things mm-hmm. that people can go through, mm-hmm. issues, and be able to come back to the council and say, you know, now I'm physically able to perform or mentally mm-hmm. able, and I think we need to provide that that flexibility to the council, and I just didn't want it to be limited to immorality or mm-hmm. or lying. It's broader than that. I think there is value for the council to be able to address specific instances. So I wanted to put that out there so the conversation was broadened a little bit.
And through the chairman, Representative Johansson, it in no way binds the council. What we are doing is allowing them another tool, as you had stated. It no way binds them to use suspension first. It no way binds them to use suspension at all, or sets out the criteria in which they could do it. It just adds that as a tool to their toolbox. But I will get some more information about when they anticipate that might be used.
Okay, thank you. Reverend Greenberg.
Just in line with what Representative Johansson was saying, we passed a bill in this body last year, and it's just in the other body now in the final stages, dealing with removal of a regent from the university. It's House Bill 6. Deals with many of the same issues.
Speak more loudly, please.
It deals with many of the same issues, House Bill 6. You might want to take a look at that, because somebody could be under suspension and be under a temporary disability, and then want to regain their license and be suspended, and they should have the ability to seek a hearing and reinstatement while the process is going on. Maybe something totally unrelated, you know, they may be entirely legal and not committed a crime or anything, but just you know, have a heart condition that they physically can't do something for a while. That's not a good example either. Broken, like, whatever.
You understand the concern?
Yes,
okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe also the personally identifying information, I think we're going to have to somehow narrow that down a little bit. That's pretty broad. I mean, that could be his name, you know. So I think we need to look at that.
Okay, thank you. We have several folks who would like to testify this morning, and I think it might be appropriate, correct me if I'm wrong, to adopt the CS and then go from there. So I'll entertain a motion to adopt, actually to remove your objection.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Objection been removed, so we will be working with the CS. Congratulations, you did a good job. A lot of distance to go on this, but at least we agree on a document you're going to be working from.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you all know where to find me for any other questions.
Oh, yeah,
I'll do my best to follow up on the ones you've asked on the record.
So we have some folks here. I'm going to call these folks from the United States and China here. I'm trying to read what this first. Somebody from
China.
From Ketchikan. Is it Richard?
My marked up thing that I put into your office was from.
Are you from Ketchikan, sir?
I am.
And your name?
Yes, sir. My name is Richard Burton. I'm retired.
I think that's it. come on up. I hope your testimony is more clear than the signature here.
And if you'll excuse me, I'm an acquaintance of Representative Johansson.
We won't hold that against
him. Since he was a young
his partnership isn't that hot either.
Okay. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Well, I'm a member of the Police Standards Council, which I have been for 14 years.
And give your name, please.
Richard Burton. B-U-R-T-O-N.
Burton?
Richard Burton, just like Elizabeth Taylor's husband.
We need to talk to you, for sure. Go ahead.
Well, sir, I'm a member of the council, but also in the audience to testify as the chairman of the council from Sitka, and, of course, the Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety, who was former director of the Police Standards Council, and some of these issues. So I have no official capacity other than give you a little bit of history, if you can bear with me. A gentleman named Pat Wallington and I, back in 1970, drafted the original law that became the Police Standards Bill. House came Senate Bill number 1 in 1971, thanks to Senator Bill Ray and Senator Curtula, who at that time were very helpful to us and a lot
of things. Which Curtula?
Jay.
Okay.
Yeah, the elder.
Yeah.
Like me. In fact, I checked, you and I are only 8 days apart from birthdays. So,
well, it was him in age.
And you're 8 days older than I am. But anyway, that's the basis of what I come here for, because I was also Commissioner of Public Safety during Jay Hammond's term, and I was Commissioner of Public Safety during the last term of Governor Wally Hickel. So those 8 years, I was automatically on the council, and I'm on it now and have been, like I say, for a total of 14 years.
You got a lot of insight into what
you're
talking about.
So I have some historic perspective about, since I worked before statehood, when there were no standards, and you'd hire a police officer, which actually happened. In those days, you fingerprinted them, sent them back to the FBI, hoped in 6 months you got something back. I remember one time we got one back. The guy had already resigned, but he was wanted for murder in California, so we had a little problem with doing that. Lots of misconduct.
A lot about homicide investigations, I'm sure.
Alaska was a pretty wild and woolly place. When I first went to work in Ketchikan as a young officer in 1954, the current chief and captain were up at the top of the federal jail under indictment for running the Crick Street Emporium, and they did a little time in the federal jail. So they came and go. Policemen came and go, came and went. Judge Jim Fitzgerald was U.S. attorney then, helped prosecute them. Statehood came along. The whole thing changed, of course. In Alaska, as you know, is the only state that's different than the rest of the country because we don't have counties. So then we had to, let's have some law enforcement on a statewide basis, and I think they did a good job in taking Department of Public Safety and making it state police, highway patrol, and what amounts to county sheriffs in the other states, which will lead me into why we ended up with court service officers. But eventually, or I'll answer questions. But that's my background, and as long as I've been on the council, when this first surfaced, the first heard of it.
Yes, you mean the bill?
The bill. I was shocked because I've been under enough. I have never seen occasion to anybody being treated so badly that would warrant trying to break something that's not broken. You know, they always say, let's don't fix something that's not broken, or don't break something that's not broken. And so other than that, individual things here, I can't officially, I can give you my personal opinion section by section, but I know you've got a lot of things to do. I'm available here.
We would value your opinion.
Questions and answers, I don't want to take up a lot of your time, but obviously you can tell that a lot of these things I see and hear are things that probably is a management and labor thing, and that's why we have collective bargaining and negotiations and binding arbitration, things that I think some of these things belong in that arena rather than being fixed by let's write another law. That's where I'm coming from.
Okay. Now, we are not going to be moving the bill today, as you heard.
Yes, sir.
And so we would value your opinions either in person or by telephone when time comes.
Well, I understand you're an old police officer, so we'd probably sit down and chew the fat all night long.
It'd be very, very interesting. Yeah.
So I thank you. I'm available if you do want to ask any questions when anything comes up.
I think you have one right here.
Yes, sir.
In the short time, that course, your comment about where court service officers came from, I'd be very interested in getting a little bit of insight into that.
Well, prior to statehood, the U.S. Marshal's office. It was all federal courts. We had no state courts, obviously, because before statehood, to be a city of first class, you had to have your own municipal court, you had to have your own attorney, you had to run your own jail. Well, with statehood, for some reason, and I don't mean this derogatory, but we decided to set up sort of a socialist form of government, that the state does everything for everybody. So some of the best justice to handle the minor problems in municipal courts and villages and things went away. So then said, well, we've got to take over the duties that the marshal's office performed in providing serving process, serving civil process, taking care of the judges, taking prisoners. It's changed now, but we also had to transport all prisoners to jail, between jails, and a lot of things. That was not something that required someone trained to the point that they can investigate homicides or sex offense cases, or still to this day. It's a security job, and the people that do that do it really well and are proud of what they do, and I don't know why we want to call them a police officer. There's two definitions in law, which I'm sure Representative Gruenberg will agree with me. There's a peace officer definition and a police officer. A police officer is the guy with the badge on the beat on the street. A peace officer can be a deputy marshal. An FBI agent is a peace officer, but he's not an Alaska police officer. These guys are peace officers, probably fit that definition, but they're not a police officer in the common definition of somebody getting in a patrol car, answering calls, writing tickets. They don't do any of that. So I don't see that they need a level of training to rise to that level. My own opinion, having been around and wrestled that as the commissioner of that department for years, though.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Who's next?
That's what on that point I have.
On that, I got a new one.
Totally new topic. Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Representative Grant, and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just comes to question. We've got X number of court officers, and if this has changed, in your experience, you know, we're going to run these people through the academy unless they're grandfathered in, and I'm wondering, you know, are all of these people going to be able to make it through the academy, and if not, we'll be recruiting new people, and is there a cost associated with training a person to that level of getting through the academy? There must be some fiscal impact to be able to, if we're going to implement this, not all of them are going to qualify, we're going to have to get new people, run them through the academy. What is your opinion on that process?
Mr. Chairman, I not being there now, I know internally the really deeply unknown condition of who all's there and who's not. But I do know that in the past, always the court service, they start out as judicial, but the court service officers didn't have the same physical requirements, for one thing. And be honest with you, in the old days when we started off, we had troopers doing it all the time, found out that was a waste of a trained trooper. But it was a place where somebody was on limited duty and couldn't work the road physically, but could handle that job fine. So I'm going to assume that there's probably some of that, and that probably if they're required, if say to meet the basic training requirements, which is I think 400 hours at the academy and a lot of physical stuff, that probably some of them will probably lose their job because they won't be able to do it. That's an assumption, but just from my experience, I would say that's very good. And it's a training that, again, I say that maybe there just need to be some kind of training involved, and I understand that the commissioner and they're talking about doing some of that, but I think that's an internal thing. It doesn't have to rise to the level of mandating it by statute and waving a wand and saying you're now a police officer. And if for that kind of training, let's say we trained those to that degree and they perform that job, 3 or 4 years of working in that job and not performing the stuff they were trained for, they're not going to know how to do it anyway, because case law changes, things on arrest. I mean, you see all the kind of things that go on around the country for challenging the law enforcement now. That's something they'd have to work in that arena.
And, Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. Would you assume, obviously, with that training, there would be a cost associated? And the reason I ask that is currently this bill has no finance referral, and I'm really, if it doesn't go to finance, then we are going to have to delve into the fiscal questions, and if we're going to be training new people through the academy, that has to cost. I mean, I don't think we've ever put an extra person in there without a fiscal note attached, so I'm concerned about the fiscal impact, and this is the only place we're going to get to discuss it, which I hope it's not, but...
We need to delve into that.
Mr. Chairman, that's a question I'm sure that the Deputy Commissioner answered. I know, I think there's something like 60 people there, and the other thing is, you can't say we're going to cut down the providing stuff to the court for the next year while we train everybody and take them all out. It's going to have to be done probably over a 4 or 5 year period of time, and it is expensive. It's going to cost money. I assume it's going to cost several hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that if they change the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
You had another?
I'm in no hurry.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming to testify. What are your feelings of giving you another tool for the toolbox? Do you think you need the suspension, or why would you rather not have it, or you think it's good? Can you go into that?
Well, I've thought a lot about that because having administered the thing and working with the council for 14 years, if it was a tool, I can't try to set in a scenario of when you could use it, because the kind of things that I've heard talked about here that it could be used for, like someone has a drug problem or alcoholic problem, those things are done every day in the arena of law enforcement administratively through management. And I remember years ago that my lieutenant called one guy in and says, go to Shadles or you lost your job. You know, that's the kind of arena that needs to be done. I don't think we're the ones to decide whether the guy has an alcoholic problem or not. And it's not we don't want to be a place that a police chief who can't take action on his own can pass it off to someone else. I really don't think that's good.
Thank you, Representative Keller.
Well, it's kind of related to that, and thank you. Your wisdom is helpful, and the insights are valuable.
I've heard that.
To me, you know, because I just knew. But to this whole topic a lot. Do you know, in your time there, do you remember any cases where there was a revocation that then subsequently recertified? And just curious.
Mr. Chairman, I can't recall one from memory, because I had breaks in my time, but there may have been some things. But actually, I've been pretty proud of that council. I've just got another comment that popped in my mind, if I'm free to say something, but you accept that as an answer right now. And that is the thing that in here that bothers me as much as anything is changing from preponderance to clear and convincing. And I heard, Representative Grunberg talks about attorneys. Well, the Bar Association is not part of the Procedures Act. And the Procedures Act covers things like other certification boards besides us, medical, doctors, teachers. You know, there's a lot. If you look at the boards in the state, there are a lot of them. And they all have the same level of proof, which is by a preponderance. So to single this agency out to have to reach that higher level, that higher standard of proof, to do the same thing that they're all doing, I think is really something. If we're going to change it, make everybody do it.
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to go back to the court service officers for a minute. And I was wondering, do you think possible reason that they would want them to get additional training could be because they're worried about needing additional security nowadays, that there may be occasionally more threats of court personnel than there may have been in prior years?
Mr. Chairman? Have you been into the Anchorage courthouse or a courthouse or across the street lately?
I've been on a jury a couple times.
Yes, sir. Well, I don't know how much more. You know, you can plan against all kinds of eventualities because there's no way that you can prevent everything. Another job I had for a while in Vietnam, I was a counterterrorist program. Somebody wants to do something, they're going to do it, and having a degree or a high level of education is not going to stop it. And I don't think there's not a simple answer. I don't think that's going to improve. The security is pretty good, and it's good. You got good people in there, and they're dedicated to their job. So I don't know. That's my opinion, of course, sitting on the outside of the department looking in, which I do. I can't give you a really black and white answer. I don't think it would.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the exclusion that you couldn't consider evidence that was generated in a disciplinary action or court, do you have independent authority to generate subpoena evidence, or if you weren't able to utilize those while they're, if it's been removed or reversed, or if it's still in dispute, do you have, under the Police Standards Council, independent ways of getting that same information if you're not allowed to use that information?
Mr. Chairman, now, Deputy Commissioner, who was the director for the council for years, could give you a specific answer because he's the one that made it operate. But yeah, they do have subpoena. We have used that to get records. I think I'm correct, and he can certainly correct me if I'm not.
Okay, thank you. And one,
go ahead.
And there were seven reasons listed here in which you could go ahead and use that. You know, if someone has falsified information to obtain a certificate, you could do it. It doesn't, or if the person has willfully falsified information to obtain a warrant or make arrests, but if the information that came about through those was that he had falsified other information, but it hadn't been used to make arrests or hadn't been falsified to obtain his certificate, then you couldn't use those that information where he had falsified other documents. Does that concern you at all, that you wouldn't be able to gather that information?
If that's, Mr. Chairman, we just got this morning. I've been trying to read it and reread it and reread it because there's a lot to digest.
That's why we're going to, not take action.
I agree with
today.
The I know that there's a lot of this that I can't give you a direct answer to, but yeah. It's not real clear how binding something previous action would actually be to prohibit the council from performing what is statutorily their responsibility. So I have some argument with some of that where I'm not understanding, is this a method for someone to slip through the cracks or it's a loophole? I think we have to wait till our attorney from the Department of Law kind of tells us what this says. So I'm really reluctant to put myself out there and say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that.
I'd like to thank you for your testimony. I would recommend that at some point maybe write a book about your experiences, really, or at least make a tape recollection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Services. Well, there's a few people have to die first.
Well, we're not going to apply.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you very much. I have to go testify for one of my fantastic bills in another committee, so I'm going to give the gavel to Vice Chair Keller at this point. I'd like to thank everybody who testified so far. I'll be back if I can. Thank you.
We have another testifier, Sheldon Schmidt. Is it Sheldon? Again,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You would identify yourself?
Sheldon Schmidt. I'm the police chief in Sitka, Alaska, and I'm also the serving on Alaska Police Standards for 4 years, and I'm currently the chairperson for APSC. There's a lot of specifics. I mean, I could really talk a lot about the specific objections I have. And first, I'd like to say I appreciate all the work that's gone into this bill. I appreciate, I think, the intention of the people that brought it forward. But I don't want to get into the specifics. I guess I want to stick to the general as much as I can. On behalf of Alaska Police Standards, we opposed this bill. And we oppose it for the fundamental principle that I think it's going to erode the standards that we enforce, that we hold our police officers to. I'm glad Dick Burke was here today, because he kind of gives a sense of the history, where we come from, why we have this law, and you know, times have changed. But if anything, I think we need these standards more than ever. I think the people expect the police officers and want to believe that the police officers stand for something. And I think this bill is going to erode the authority of APSC, of the Police Standards Council, our ability to take somebody's certification away. I think it's going to undermine the public trust in our law enforcement community. And so, therefore, I oppose this law.
Good testimony. Don't see any questions at this time. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And one of the things that we had talked about, I mean, there's a couple of different policy issues. And one of them was the suspension. And I believe Representative Wilson asked this as well. And I'd like to get your idea on the idea of having a suspension and whether that changes the what the Police Standards Council is doing and how it would tend to operate if you started applying suspensions to different situations. And I don't know if it would be appropriate in some situations or not in others, but generally would that change the mission of the Police Standards Council as well?
It may. There are other states that have suspension as part of their purview. And I could see it being a tool for the police standards to use in specific cases. I mean, you don't have to almost have to talk about scenarios. But then I would worry about the mission drift if we're going to suddenly being, APSC is suddenly going to be acting as a disciplinary agency as opposed to a regulatory agency, deciding whether somebody meets the standards of certification. So I can see both sides of that issue. I'm more comfortable sticking with what we have, honestly. We're familiar with it. I can definitely think of scenarios that, where suspension could be an avenue for somebody to attempt to change their behavior. I guess maybe it would be a slap on the wrist as opposed to a revocation. And for that reason alone, I'm a little bit scared of it.
President Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was wondering if you thought that, or could give me your opinion on the suspension issue. Would that give due process a little more time to take place, to have a thorough investigation before a revocation? And because, I mean, losing your license, if you've been a career police officer, is akin to the death penalty. And do you think it's maybe slightly more fair to allow more time for due process to take place and by allowing a suspension for a period of time and until all the information can be investigated and then a decision could be made?
I mean, I think that's a persuasive argument. I mean, that would be the intention of it. Most departments put somebody on administrative leave, paid or unpaid, for that due process to take place, in effect, a suspension. So I understand what you're saying, and I can see how that could be a useful tool, honestly.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, and I'm asking it because I really don't know, but I'm seeing a possibility. You hear when you are have someone before you and you're trying to figure things out, and they plead for their own case. Do you feel that if some of them, I know most of them are just super wonderful people, and but there are some that, you know, we have to look at and you have to look at. Is there a possibility that if they knew that there was a suspension and that they, those people that Oh, well, if I can just get it suspended and I can argue for that, maybe I will take a chance a little bit more than normal. I don't know. I'm just asking you that.
I think you're getting to the heart of the matter and why I'm uncomfortable with this bill in general. I learned a lesson as a lieutenant years ago that, and it kind of goes against my own human nature, that discipline is very important to the health of a police department. If you look at the departments that are in trouble around the state where they have officers misbehaving, it's usually because of a lack of management taking disciplinary action. So yes, in a nutshell, I think that taking firm, clear action and decisive disciplinary measures is, it's basic to the health of any organization, as well as the health of the profession statewide. So yeah, I think so. I think if you feel like it's a little bit slippery, maybe I'll get by this time, or maybe that other guy got by with a suspension, then it could promote bad behavior, which we definitely don't want to do.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you, testimony. Just a real brief at ease. Vance? You're Vance?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Jake Metcalf?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. My name is Jake Metcalf, and I'm the Executive Director of the Public Safety Employees Association. I'm also with Steve Sorensen, our General Counsel. And I'll keep it brief. I know you have a busy schedule. We are here to answer questions. I guess I would like to discuss a couple of issues that have come up that I wasn't able to testify about the last time I testified. First, I'd like to comment on the court service officer certification. You heard a little bit about that prior to my testimony. Court service officers currently work in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and some of our rural communities. They carry guns, and they have jurisdiction within the courthouse. They are not certified, and what this bill would do is certify them. I can tell you what court service officers do now, and I know that there's a history and you've heard that. I'd like to talk about what they do now. They have a badge, they carry a gun, they wear a uniform, they transport prisoners on a daily basis between our courthouses in vehicles, they transport prisoners in airplanes carrying a gun. They investigate crimes that happen on the courthouse. You may remember back in, I think it was December or January, there was a domestic violence hearing going on in the Anchorage courthouse. I believe a scuffle of some kind broke out, and there was a chase of the perpetrator of the scuffle, left the courthouse, and the court service officer pursued him and caught him and arrested him, took him into custody. So we think by all the standards, court service officers are police officers. They do those type of duties. They serve warrants. They go around the community to serve warrants. They serve process. They drive around the community to serve that process. I just point out to you that the statute certifies VPSOs in our rural communities. They're trained. They do some limited investigations of misdemeanor crimes. But they don't carry weapons. We think by certifying court service officers, you address a liability problem with the state of Alaska. We think it's necessary. Our members who are court service officers want to be certified. There are different levels of certification. There's basic, intermediate, and advanced. We believe that a certification under those areas is very possible and needed for court service officers, and we see them as police just like airport and university police who are certified in this state and have a limited jurisdiction to the areas that they police. Airport police and fire are the the police that have the jurisdiction at the airport, and university police in Anchorage and Fairbanks have jurisdiction at the university. We see it as something that betters policing here and is good for the court system, and is something that's been long overdue. I'll address the suspension, since that's been an issue that has been raised with witnesses. We think suspension is another tool, and I think Representative Johansson hit the nail on the head with his comments about that. It's not mandatory. It's a decision that the board would make, and then they would look at individual situations. And under the standards that are there right now, Representative Johansson pointed out, emotional and mental issues. You have crimes with what's proposed in this bill. A Class A misdemeanor would be something that would subject a certified police officer to revocation. I know from my experience as a prosecutor and as an executive director of this organization, there are a number of fish and game violations that involve Class A misdemeanors. In those sorts of situations, it may not be the kind of conduct that calls for revoking a license of a police officer that may have received $300,000 to $500,000 in training and has a great record as a police officer that made a mistake. So it is just another tool in the belt. It modernizes the statutes and regulations that govern the APSC, and it's a change that's needed. And we think that it was great that they created an APSC and developed an organization that certifies and can revoke certifications. But we think the time has come to modernize that. And, just to reiterate what Representative Gruenberg said, that the process needs to be right, fair, and just. And we think that the changes in this bill address that. And we'd ask you to look at the CS and pass the CS. And I don't have any further comments. I'm open up for questions.
Representative,
thank you. I know you want to get wrapped up by 9:30, but just very quickly, do you believe that the training for the court officers that is included in the CS would incur costs to the state for training those officers?
Any kind of training is going to cost money, but right now they get training, and it's a matter of how much more training you get. We have court service officers that have gone to academies. They've gone down to the academy in Sitka. It's the kind of training you get. They should be trained because of the job that they do. So there's going to be a cost already to that. It's a matter of setting up what level of certification you have for those officers. It depends on where you have the training. I don't think it's necessary to send everybody to the academy, but I think the department probably is the best judge of that. So there's costs already. It's a question of, how much certification you're going to require and the types of training you offer those people to do their jobs.
Mr. Chairman, just two things. There most likely will be more training on for somebody. I know they're already trained and we pay for it, but if we're going to increase the standards, then they're going to have to get more training. Some of them are, I would imagine, and that's going to cost money. And then my question is, if we change the status, the definition, or the however you want to describe it, of the officer who's across the street right now, change their training or level, is that going to cause an increase in their compensation when we go through the operating budget and we go to their line item? Is that position going to now cost more because they're highly trained? Are we going to get the argument that, well, they're highly trained now, we need to pay them more?
No, you're not. I mean, they have a classification. Their classification is already one that receives training. If you want to make them an advanced police officer with all the duties that a state trooper has, then that's an issue that I don't think is going to come up, because that's not what we're asking. They're not doing those types of duties. Right now, we collectively bargain at the classification standard for a court service officer. You know, if they have a certification, that doesn't change their classification.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Is your organization that you work for going to approach the Department of Administration to change the classification description for those positions?
We think that the...
Based on this, if this bill passed and the training was higher, are you going to go and ask for that description to change from what it currently is, therefore possibly increasing the compensation?
That's not our intent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson?
Representative Seaton, what we're going to do, because of the time, I want to explain just a little housekeeping. We'll take a break after this testimony. And Jeffrey Mittman, if you're, I know Representative Gruenberg has questions for you, and we have Kate.
We can do that the next hearing. I don't care.
Okay. Okay.
We got a lot of other people here.
Yeah. Okay. And we got, just one more, and then Kate Sheehan. Kate. Yeah, okay. Well, then we can, we'll set the bill aside and keep the public testimony open. But go ahead, Representative Wilson has a question.
And I'm not expecting an answer today, but for next time, if you can get it ready. I would like to know that the amount of hours that the training is now for those officers, and then how many hours training is it if they go to the next level and that a full police officer has to have, and so that I would know the difference there. And that's basically what I'd like to know by next time.
You want to go ahead? Or I believe the basic is 400 hours, but the department can give you the exact numbers, but we're happy to get those to you too at the next hearing.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had testimony earlier that termination notices are sent to the Police Standards Council. We weren't given the information that administrative leave or other personnel actions goes to the Police Standards Council. So if we're talking about suspension of a license based on things like alcohol, physical, mental conditions, or whatever, would that rise to the Police Standards Council unless they were terminated from their job? I mean, if it's an administrative leave while a municipal police force deals with someone that had an alcohol problem, they have to go through training and all those things. I'm not seeing the connection of why it would ever be at the Police Standards Council while the person's under administrative leave because they haven't been terminated. And so I'm unaware of why you would get to the level of where you would need a suspension of a license when the employer puts people on administrative leave for those kinds of reasons.
Through the chair. Representative Seaton, I think I can answer your question, and if I don't, please let me know, and I'll try to answer it. As I understand it, when a person gets terminated, the department sends over what's called an F-4 form, and it explains why they've been terminated. But as I know from personal experience in my job and from what I gather from the testimony of Mr. Sexton at a prior hearing, in addition to getting notice from the department that someone's been terminated, there can be complaints filed by the public about the conduct of a police officer, or the APSC can be reading a newspaper and see a story about some conduct of a police officer. And I assume that there could even be self-reporting about conduct. And, you know, I would hope that if there was some sort of situation, people would self-report. But that information comes into the Police Standards Council, and they make a decision then about what kind of action they're going to take and whether or not the conduct that they become aware of rises to the level that a standard has been violated, that the council needs to determine whether or not a person's certification is revoked. And then that's up to the administration of the council to make that decision. So there's different ways that they can get the information rather than just a termination notice from the department.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to keep public testimony open. Jeffrey, I have to apologize. I did. Are you willing and able to call back next time when this bill comes up? Are you online? He left. Okay, so he got the message, but I'll have to apologize to him personally. So we'll set this bill aside right now, and what we'd like to do is have Vance, if you would come up, Governor, confirmation to, is it APOC? And so if you would identify yourself for the record and tell us why you want to do this job, and we'll entertain questions.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is Vance Sanders. I reside at 9547 North Douglas Highway, Juneau, Alaska. And why I want to do this job, I think it would be interesting work. I am friends with Elizabeth Hickerson, who's chair of APOC. Her husband was the person who hired me to come to Alaska in 1983. And Ms. Hickerson has told me she finds it to be interesting work and important. And when I was asked if I would be willing to be nominated, I said I would. And I think it would be interesting, rewarding work. For many years, I've been, and Representative Gruenberg knows this, I've been involved with Alaska Legal Services, both as an attorney, and I've been on the Board of Legal Services since 1993. And I feel like in that time, I've gotten to, or I've become acquainted with people from all across Alaska, and that's been a really interesting learning experience with attorneys from all judicial districts and with our lay people who are on the board, who are indigent, typically indigent Alaska natives from throughout Alaska. And that has taught me that Alaska is an amazing place on many levels, culturally, economically, socially, and I think it kind of all bubbles up to APOC at some point. And I think that's kind of the, in an interesting way, it's sort of where things coalesce and the policies there, of which I have to tell you, I'm not all that familiar. I've been gone out of state on a Civil War battle tour, and I went to the Final Four this weekend, so all that came in while I was gone. But I haven't really had a chance to digest all of it yet, but I will, and if confirmed, I will. And I appreciate the opportunity to serve, and I would appreciate your consideration.
Any questions? Representative Peterson and Representative Gruenberg and Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sanders, I was wondering, have you ever run for political office or worked on a campaign as a campaign manager or campaign treasurer where you may have had a chance to familiarize yourself with some of the campaign laws and rules and regulations?
Representative Peterson, through the vice chair, I have never run for political office, at least since I graduated from high school. I have worked on political campaigns. I worked in North Carolina for Representative Galifianakis when he ran for Congress in North Carolina. I also worked for Senator, he was at that time Senator Hunt, Jim Hunt, in one of his campaigns. And I was involved with the North Carolina student legislature when I was in college at the University of North Carolina. So, but never as a vice chair or any managerial capacity. I was just a grunt, more or less. I've contributed to campaigns over the years, but I, you know, as a practicing lawyer, I've been in private practice now for 20 years, and I just don't have time to get involved, frankly, in political campaigns. So,
okay, thanks.
Representative Gruenberg wants Representative Johansson to go ahead in.
I'll yield.
Well, you must have a really good one.
You'll find out.
Thanks for, first of all, putting your name up for this. We all know APOC is a very difficult place to be in this building, but I appreciate that. My question is really very basic, and that is, what is your opinion of the role of the Alaska Public Offices Commission, and what part of that do you see yourself integrating into?
That's a great question. Representative Johansson, through the vice chair, I think the role of APOC, at least as I understand it, and again, I haven't looked at all the provisions that apply to it, but as I understand it, it is essentially a watchdog for lobbyists and for people who intend to run for public office, making sure the reports are filed in a timely manner. And they are essentially the consumer arm for the political process in the state, is my understanding. That's a simplification, but that's my understanding of what their role is. What I would bring to that, I think, is you know, I don't have any political axe to grind. I don't, you know, a lot of my private practices as a mediator, particularly an arbitrator, where, you know, you don't inject your opinion on the process, and that's what I intend to do, is to try to be a fair and neutral person who understands the standards and seeks equally to apply them to the persons, you know, who are regulated, and I use the term, I guess regulated is the proper term, who are reviewed by APOC.
And then one follow-up, if you don't mind. I noticed that you were recommended for a judicial vacancy recently. Are you still, if that opportunity came up again, would you continue to approach that, or can we count on you being at APOC for a few years? Or?
Well, I guess you never say never, Representative Johansson, but I have no intention at this time of putting my name back in the hat for judgeship. I went that route one time. I thought it was a good opportunity. I was nominated by the Judicial Council. I wasn't chosen by the governor. I respect, you know, his decision, the person he put in there. I think has done a great job, and I have no intention at this time for applying for a judgeship, for a justiceship.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go last because I wanted to I wanted to really make more of a statement than a question. I've known Mr. Sanders for a long time, and I have the highest respect for him. I know he has a terrific reputation at the bar, and I'm very pleased that the governor nominated you, and I've been waiting for this opportunity to put in a good word on your behalf. And I think he couldn't have chosen a better person.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for putting your name forward. Doesn't pay real well. we need good people in those roles. So thank you. And when we're just deciding the day to move your name forward, doesn't have any reflection on support or negative or whatever, just moving your name to the full body. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we left you plenty of time to...
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Do you wish a motion?
Yes, that would be great.
I will move that we forward Mr. Sanders' name to the joint session for consider confirmation for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And as always, signing the report does not imply how a member will vote.
Seeing no objection, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
And I believe there will be a paper coming around that we'll sign. Let's move to Senate Bill 53.
May we go off the record for 1 minute, please?
Oh, yeah, we'll take a brief at ease. If you would give us a description of SB 53.
I thought we'd done that already.
Did we?
We
did that last week.
It's the Girl Scout.
You want a date on here? We put a date on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. True. Okay. Well, that's what happens when we pass the gavel back and forth. So what we'll do is tell us about the other one, then the Girl Scout one, and then we'll have both of them on the record. I don't have an intent to move. I'm going to wait for the chair's guidance on this. So
we're going to be very brief with SCR 17.
Okay. So this is SCR number 17, and it's a State Affairs, Senate State Affairs version, right, of the CS?
The version for the record, I'm Senator Betty Davis, and I represent District 5. And I'm here to present SCR 17.
We have version B, right? Is what we're
yes. It's the original, yes.
Bravo.
Version M, I believe.
Okay, let's make sure we have the right. Yes, okay, you're right. I'm glad we did that. It's
version M.
Version M, which is a finance version. Thank you. If you would, go ahead and tell us about the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me to present this resolution. For the record, my name is Katya Wasley. I'm an intern for Senator Davis. Founded by Juliet Gordon Lowe in Savannah, Georgia in 1912, Girl Scouts of the USA now has approximately 2.3 million girl members and 890,000 adult members working as volunteers, for a total of approximately 3.2 million members. Also, 50 million women in the United States today are Girl Scout alumna. In Alaska, there are about 6,000 Girl Scouts and 1,500 volunteers active today. The experience of being a Girl Scout is one that produces growth on many levels. Through the Girl Scout experience, girls develop a strong sense of self, positive values such as a sense of social responsibility and citizenship, practical and healthy life skills, a drive for facing and overcoming challenges, and the ability to think critically and examine the different viewpoints in a situation. Such developments are carried over to many other aspects of life for girls and become invaluable as girls transition into adulthood and take on greater responsibilities. The difference that involvement in the Girl Scouts makes in the lives of girls is indicated by the fact that 10 out of 17, or 59% of women in the United States Senate, are former Girl Scouts, 45 of 75, or 60% of women in the United States House of Representatives are former Girl Scouts, and 53% of all women business owners were once Girl Scouts. Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 recognizes the positive impact that the Girl Scouts of the United States of America has made on our society throughout the past 100 years and commemorates them by declaring 2012 to be the Year of the Girl. A very brief overview. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
No questions?
No, I will say.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My mother was a Girl Scout. My wife was a Girl Scout. I couldn't join, so I was a Boy Scout.
Of course.
And this is a great resolution, and I'd like to commend the senator, good senator, for authoring it, and you for presenting it. You guys did a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's almost like I would need to recuse myself from voting because my wife is a service manager for the Southern Kenai Peninsula Girl Scouts, and so we've been involved with Girl Scouts for about 30 years down there, or 30 plus years, on the Southern Kenai Peninsula. And so, but I really appreciate the resolution, and hope for in the future may be able to honor Girl Scouts and the activities they perform and the services they perform for the state of Alaska.
Thank you. I'm sure you are aware of the information that's floating around on the internet, and I would like to give you opportunity to respond to your connection, the Girl Scout connection with Planned Parenthood and the activist role in that. Is there a connection? Is there not? I mean, frankly, I haven't looked into it, but I see it's out there. I just wanted to make a statement.
I don't have a statement to make on that.
Okay.
I'm not familiar that the Girl Scouts is tied up with anything with the Planned Parenthood, and that's not a part of this, so I have no answer.
Yeah. And that's
okay. Or no comment.
We'll talk about that. That's part of the reason I'm not moving, because I want to look into that some more.
I would like for you to give me the information that you're referring to, because I don't even know what you're talking about.
Great, okay.
And I don't see how that could hold up a celebration of the Girl Scouts for 100 years in services that they have provided, and also making this the Year of the Girl, 2012. I don't see the connection, and if that was a concern, someone should have shared it with me prior to me coming here. You shouldn't throw that on me at the point that I give my presentation, that you're holding up a bill simply because of some information that you have that I don't have.
Right. Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't do my homework, and it isn't the death knell to the bill at all. Just a little hesitation at this point. We have plenty of time to end this session, so we'll talk about
it. I certainly hope so.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think it's the Girl Scouts have got a great history. It's been a wonderful organization, and they just completed their annual sale of cookies, and I saw them hauling them up and down the halls in the Capitol building here by the wagon loads. So I know we all took part in buying some cookies and consuming them, and there's probably still a few of them left on shelves in people's offices. Although I think we've completed all ours in my office at this point. But I certainly plan on supporting this resolution when it comes up for a vote at a later time.
Okay, thank you. So we'll put this bill aside at this time, and then we'll go to right into SCR
or SB 53, so if you just stay right there if you like.
I will.
Yeah. And we have the reason we're opening the bill, again, we're not going to move it this late date. Wait until we get the chair back and get his direction. But we have three testifiers, and if you wanted to refresh our memory where we're at, I had forgotten that you presented it. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway, and we have three in the room to testify in about 15 minutes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I stated, I am Senator Davis, representing District K, Anchorage. I have my aide who will give another, just a brief explanation, because they did that at the last time so that you could move into the public testimony.
For the record, my name is Celeste Hodge. I'm staff to Senator Betty Davis. As shared at the previous committee meeting, staggering statistics for women in Alaska showed the need to reestablish the Alaska Women's Commission. With the high rates of sexual assault, domestic violence, there is a great need, and the low poverty rate. I can go into all the statistics, but there is a definite need. The statistics back it up, and that's my reintroduction of the bill.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to reserve my questions. I strongly support the bill, but we have other people to testify, and I'd like to give them the courtesy.
Thank you, Representative Greenberg. We'll start, I think, with Arliss Sturgiluski, who's online, and then we have two in a room, Barbara Belknap and Marie Darlin, and we also have Guy Bell from the department, from the governor's office here for questions, if there's questions on the fiscal or whatever. So, Arliss, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate an opportunity to testify very briefly.
If you would, just give us your name, and we know who you are, but it puts it on the record, and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Arliss Sturgiluski, and I'm here representing myself. I served in the legislature just shortly after the bill was passed in 1978, and was there for its reactivation. I was sorry to see the bill go out. I think there is a need for a women's commission. We have some real issues in the foster child care, for the still alarming to me dropout of high school students, both male and female, and we have a lot of kids that need to go on to higher education. I know the legislature has addressed that issue, but there's a very strong economic divide between rural and urban Alaska. I travel pretty extensively still because I've maintained my interest in many issues facing the state, traveled in rural Alaska, and I think there's a real need for a commission that can do special studies, but take a look at some of the major issues and distribute information to people. So I hope you can find a way to support this bill, and the fact that you're providing funding for it is absolutely important. It just helps to be able to afford for travel and some of the necessaries so that people can really get out to rural Alaska, travel around the state, and take public testimony, which then can be refined into some good studies that help women. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for taking time to testify. I don't see any questions at this time, so thank you. Oh, we have one. Representative Greenberg. Uh-huh.
Again, this seems to be the day for making statements. It's always a pleasure to hear from you, Senator. Thank you so much for coming down and testifying.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Barbara Belknap in the room. You would identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Belknap. I last appeared before most of you as the executive director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. I retired in 2002. And I'm here today as one of two Alaska delegates to Vision 2020, which is a Drexel University College of Medicine program to achieve equality for women by 2020 in five specific areas. One is to increase the number of women in senior leadership positions in American life, achieve pay equity, educate employers about the value of policies and practices that enable men and women to share fairly their family responsibilities, and educate new generations of girls and boys to respect their differences, and mobilize women in America to vote. I remember when the Alaska Commission on the Status of Women shut its doors during Governor Hickel's administration. A few months later, there was a women's conference in Centennial Hall here in Juneau, and hundreds of women gathered from around the state. A large group of us met after the conference ended, literally as men were cleaning up around us, and we wanted to talk about the governor's decision about the Women's Commission before we went back to our homes all around the state. We came up with an idea that soon became the Alaska Women's Network. It was a website and listserv that connected women across the state. Another group of women came up with Alaska Women Speak, a writer's journal for Alaska women. I was one of the co-founders of the Alaska Women's Network, and I was president for many years. I am also a contributor to Alaska Women Speak. But a website with resources for women and a quarterly journal, while good vehicles for communicating across this vast state, could not replace an official women's commission with staff and resources. What we learned at the Alaska Women's Network is that women need a central place to find information. AWN has a lot of information, but it's passive and does not generate new resources for the women of our state. We women did what women do. We found a way to make it work until someone in a position of power could bring the official Women's Commission back. Governor Parnell has made reducing violence against Alaska women one of his top priorities. The Alaska Commission on the Status of Women printed the Criminal Law and Violence Against Women Handbook. It was in plain English with a glossary in the back. It also covered adoption, name changes, other legal matters that might come up for a woman in Alaska. At one time, I had another Alaska Women's Commission report, and it was a statewide study of why girls dropped out of school, which is unfortunately still a timely issue. In addition to updating old studies, the commission could take a hard look at the wage gap for women in this state. It is against federal law to pay a woman less than a man for the same job, but no matter how you cut it, women all over Alaska make less money than men in the same jobs. This impacts them, their families, their communities, and the state. The Juneau Economic Development Council's 2011 report on Juneau and Southeast economic indicators laid out the wage disparity in every civilian job and at every education level. The report says that nationally, men earned 29% more than their female counterparts in 2009. In Alaska, men earned 37% more for full-time year-round employment. In Juneau, which we think of as a government town, where one would expect wage parity, men earned as much as 42% more than their female counterparts. While many women, including myself, reacted with surprise at these figures, where could we go with that information? Who would dig into those numbers and find out if federal wage laws are being broken or, to be kind, are not understood by employers? Representative Munoz told me that her grandmother, Thelma Engstrom, introduced legislation in the Alaska Territorial Legislature in 1946 for pay equity between men and women. That was 66 years ago, and we aren't there. It is a fact that far too many women earn less than men for the same jobs. It's illegal, it's not fair, and it impacts our economy. It is also a fact that Alaska leads the country in violence by men against women. It's a fact that the cost of living in Alaska is high, and low-income women can get stuck in dangerous relationships because they cannot afford to take care of themselves and their children. Pay equity and prevention of violence against women are two of my specific interests. The Senator Davies bill encompasses a wide and wise range of issues that affect women and need to be addressed. There are around 200 state and city women's commissions in this country. a few weeks ago, I was a guest speaker at the State League of Women Voters Convention in Anchorage. I was struck once again by the volunteer work that women do in this state. Every one of those women is dedicated to making Alaska a better place. Multiply them by the thousands of other women around the state who give of their time to help in schools, libraries, hospitals, shelters, visitors bureau, and other civic endeavors. The governor and the legislature can send all Alaskans a message that the women are valued for the contributions that we make in this state. I ask you to support Senate Bill 53 to improve the status of the women of this great state in all aspects of our lives. No nonprofit can do the caliber of work an official women's commission can do if it is fully funded, nonpartisan, and supported by the governor and the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. If you would, if you could provide a copy of that, your notes there to the recorder, I think it'd be helpful if we could.
I will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we have exactly 2 minutes left for Karen. We're not going to get to any debate or discussion on the bill today. And Marie Darlin from ARP was here, but she looks like she had to leave. So you get the last word today, and you've got 2 minutes.
Very quickly. Again, thank you for letting me come before you today, Mr. Chairman. And again, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Women's Lobby today. The Women's Lobby has been supportive of Alaska Women's Commission since the early 80s and would be ecstatic to see it be reestablished in the governor's office and be a full functioning commission again. A Women's Commission could provide relevant materials to policymakers in both the executive and the legislative branch, government geared toward improving lives of women. A Women's Commission could provide a forum for women together across the state and exchange ideas and develop their own strategies for improving their lives. But I kind of want to bring to you, we kind of been talking about the past, but just thinking about the future, you know, questions for a modern Women's Day Commission. How can we increase women's voices, participation in moving Alaska forward in the 20th century? What issues will bring women voters to the poll and involve them into the political process? What jobs are young women aged 16 to 20 interested in, and are there education and skill building training opportunities for them in Alaska? Are those jobs available in Alaska? How can workplace be supported to achieve pay equity? As we've heard, we still have a major problem in this state. Would love to also, another question is, how do the cost of health care affect women's decision in seeking preventive care in this state? How can we reduce barriers to women access to health care, no matter what the age of the woman? And then obviously the most, another very important one, and we always want to keep in mind, and that's the economic status of older women. The services that are available, what are the needs of older women, 60 plus, I'm in that age level now, and how are we meeting those needs? So I just say I think it's time again for us to support another state women's commission and would really appreciate you moving it forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, it's always a pleasure to have Representative Robinson.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. With that, we made it 30 seconds late, but we're done at 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Is that adjournment?
Adjournment. I'm sorry.